The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. Today, it's an episode many have been looking forward to. It's your chance to ask a question of Barton McNeil in a segment that we're calling Ask Bart. Scott, some people might be wondering, why are we having an episode where Bart is addressing listeners firsthand?
As a journalist, I like immediacy. I like to have as intimate a relationship between the listeners or the audience and the folks that we're reporting on as possible. And I got to thinking, you know, I haven't heard any podcasts where they've allowed the listeners to ask questions directly of the defendant in the case. And I thought, you know, this is something we really ought to give a try to and see how it works. I mean, I think Bart is so eager to share his thoughts and respond to the questions and do these things. I mean, I talk to Bart. He calls me probably a couple times a week, and we talk about whatever I'm working on, and he was game for answering questions. And I got to add that this is really unusual. Usually, attorneys will tell their clients, be quiet, don't talk to anybody, don't answer questions, just stay quiet and let us be your spokesperson. But this is very different. I mean, Bart is being very open and willing to answer the questions, and I think it could be very interesting, the kind of responses we're getting to get from him.
What kind of response, Scott, did we get to our request for questions for Bart from among our listeners?
It was absolutely awesome, Willis. I mean, we had folks from Australia and all over the world responding. And I'm sorry to say, I mean, because we only had about an hour on the phone with Bart. We're not going to be able to ask every question that was sent to us, but we're asking a bunch of the questions, and some of the questions that were asked were things that I had never even thought to ask him as a reporter, so I'm excited about hearing what his responses are.
And we'll hear from some of our listeners, our audience, firsthand to Bart. It's okay, Scott, let's get to our first question then for Bart.
We have Elisa Greenberg from Philadelphia.
And my question is, I was wondering if Ms. Sook would have been able to just peer into the window of the computer room that you were sitting in during the night of the murder, because from what it sounded like, she would have to climb up onto something to look into the room. And I was wondering if that would make noise or a disturbance, and if anybody else or yourself would have been able to hear her.
I was in the front of the apartment in the living room. There are two easily seen from the crime scene photographs. If the caller would like to go to the website and look, I believe all the photographs are there. You've probably seen them too. The sill is probably 4 feet off the ground, so Masuk would not have needed to step on anything other than step through some foliage, some bushes, and these tall weeds below the window, which incidentally were trampled the next morning. But she wouldn't have needed to have stood on anything to have peered through the little gap between the Venetian blinds and the window molding to have seen me plain as day sitting there right at the computer. And I'm sure she would have done so, even if she hadn't. She could have seen that the light was on. She knew that I spent a lot of time at the computer. She probably could see the movement of me through the Venetian blinds, even if she hadn't, you know, actually gone right up there and peered in the window. So, no, she could easily look through the window without making any noise at all and seen me fairly easily and known what I was doing and exactly where I was.
All right. Thank you very much, Bart. And Scott, what's our next question about?
It's coming from a woman named Diane. She has several questions here. I'll read them out here. I want to know what Bart thought at the time before his conviction about his chances for a fair trial in McLean County. Did he feel his judge was going to be impartial? Did he feel his public defender was going to do a good job? How was he treated by the McLean County court system? Was he treated impartially by the jail? Was he kept in jail and isolated from the other inmates? Does he feel his public defender met with him sufficiently and was on top of his case? Did his public defender listen to him, and was he open to his input? What did the public defender tell him his reasons were for wanting a bench trial rather than a jury trial? Did Barton feel in control of his decision-making?
All right, let's find out Bart's response.
No, not at all. I don't think I was treated fairly. I was horribly railroaded, but the jailhouse staff treated me, as expected, decently enough. I was in semi-isolation in protective custody only because I had a child murder and was facing, you know, a pretty serious case. I was in a pod with six other guys that were in protective custody. So I was more or less isolated from the majority of the jail population for my safety, I guess. The public defender, I was assigned two of them. Interestingly, one of them had been my divorce attorney, and she had personally got into it with Masuk over my divorce one time. So when she was appointed to my case, it was kind of interesting that she knew of her temperament anyway. My relations with my public defenders were not good. Every time we went to a pretrial hearing, he seemed to be like completely clueless of the basic facts and circumstances that were really important to whatever the hearing was on that particular day. And while the prosecutors just steamrolled over him, during which he could have easily refuted almost everything they had said based on the investigative paperwork that I was shuffling and laying right in front of him as they spoke, he just sit there silently and essentially defer to everything the prosecutor said. So, after this had happened, I don't know, five or six times, not only was I questioning his competence, I was questioning his possibly hidden agenda. I had thought the judge was fairly impartial, but he seemed to be bowled over at every pretrial hearing by the prosecutor's baseless claims and essentially ruled in their favor, you know, on every motion hearing. And all I could do is just sit there and shake my head like, hey, I didn't do this. Somebody, you know, stop the steamroller, please.
All right, very good. Thank you. And Scott, our next question.
It comes from Tammy in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Bart, I wanted to ask you about, when was your last contact with Masuk before Christina's death? And what was the nature of that contact?
This was the final argument and breakup between Masuk and myself, the showdown that we had at this restaurant just a few hours before Christina's murder. Anyway, I finally agreed to meet her at this restaurant, this Italian restaurant, Bavanti's. I decided I wasn't going to pick up Christina until later on, so I didn't want Christina being present during what I was sure was going to be a fight. So I met her about 6 o'clock at this Italian restaurant, and within 10 minutes, we were arguing pretty bitterly mainly over her own revelations of the extent to which she had been stalking me and stalking my phone records through her employer and picking up my garbage off the curb to go through to find out what I'd been doing. But anyway, this was the last time I personally saw Masuk. She, after our fight ended, she went to my car and she wouldn't get out of my car. And I'm like, I'm threatening to call the police and everything. So finally she gets out of my car. She follows me to Christina's mother's house. I pulled over and I got out of the car. I said, Masuk, what the hell are you doing following me? Get lost, bug out, don't follow me. I'm going to pick up Christina and that's it. And that was the last time that I personally saw her prior to Christina's murder.
Our next questions are coming from Aphrodite Jones. She was a guest, as you folks will remember, on an earlier podcast. She is a world-renowned true crime writer. She's authored several books, has her own television show on the IG channel, and looks at a variety of different cases.
Why wouldn't he immediately jump to the conclusion when he's saying it's a murder on the phone to the police that it was this woman, that it was Masuk? I just find there's a lapse there, a gap there that doesn't make sense.
Why I didn't think of this didn't occur to me. I had no reason to suspect an intrusion had happened up until then. I saw no obvious signs of trauma or you know, stab wounds or anything like that. I assumed it was a sudden natural cause of illness or something. That's why I didn't jump to the conclusion, you know, without having seen the evidence, you know, meaningful evidence, that it was the farthest thing from my mind, quite frankly.
Why is he allowing her to be anywhere near his three-year-old?
Because 90% of the time, she was rather ordinary. Yeah, she had issues here and there, but she hadn't really overtly struck me or anything like that. Her problems were more psychological. So I never felt, until the very end, that she posed a physical danger.
Why did it take time for him to come up with this idea that he was going to get a confession out of Masuk that she molested his daughter and probably used one of her vibrators on Christina? That is just so off the charts weird.
That's a fair question. And the answer is pretty easy. The police implied or said or inferred from their questioning that some evidence existed that Christina's death had been accompanied by some sort of sexual abuse. Okay, well, sexual abuse and rape and whatnot is usually committed with male anatomy. And since Masuk herself does not have male anatomy, I reasoned that whatever it was that had violated her had was a foreign object. And since I knew Masuk had foreign objects that basically were a substitute for male anatomy, I mean, I guess he could have used her hand or something, but since the police eventually, finally, did go to her apartment and take these into custody and send them off to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, they must have thought that my suspicions were warranted enough to do that themselves.
All right, very good. Thank you very much. That's Barton McNeil speaking to us from the Menard Correctional Center in Southern Illinois. This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern along with Scott Reeder. We're doing a segment today called Ask Bart. And Scott, what is our next question?
His name is Bob Ruff. He is a former arson investigator from Michigan who hosts the true crime podcast Truth and Justice.
I would like to know, did he know the exact injuries, exactly what was found? Because he certainly was able to describe his theory of exactly how that would have happened in a way that doesn't fit with the injuries. Now, they had told him, these were the injuries like this is what we think, then sure, in your mind you come up with a hypothesis what could fit that. But if all they told him was there's signs of sexual assault, and then he comes out and describes something that someone else could have done that would have caused those exact same injuries, that would be another big red flag.
When I had mentioned the stuff, you know, later on, this is after, toward the end of these several interviews of me, by then the police had made it clear to me that they thought that Christina had suffered from sexual abuse. Otherwise, I'd have never mentioned the vibrators. I mean, the only reason I mentioned them is because the police had told me and implied through the nature of their questions that this had occurred. So, again, this is a perfectly reasonable thing for me to say in response to their allegation that Christina had suffered from some sort of molestation or sex abuse during the course of her murder.
What caused him to all of a sudden make that leap that he believes that there was a murder and foul play? I would like to know the answer to that question.
I leaped to nothing. This is completely untrue, and it's based on some erroneous premises. My suspicions that Christina had been murdered developed much later on, probably not until 5 or 6 hours after Christina's death. Masuk was behind the bedroom window break-in resulting in Christina's death. Clearly, Masuk had murdered my daughter. I don't know what other conclusions I could possibly have drawn from this evidence personally known to me that I'd witnessed myself. And this question sort of conflicts with the Aphrodite Jones question that had asked quite the opposite. What took you so long? So, I mean, you can't have it both ways. But, you know, again, this is no leap. It was 10 hours before I called the police back to the scene after I had seen the evidence. And my first mention of Christina having been murdered didn't occur until I had returned to the scene and personally examined the condition of the window, which was not in that condition yesterday. I know that for an absolute fact.
Hey, thanks, Bart. I really appreciate you answering that question for us. It was. Our next question is coming from Charlie Worrell. a podcaster in Kansas City. She's also the mother of six and co-hosts the podcast Insight.
Why did he think he didn't hear it? And I also wondered, did he leave the home at any point that evening? Did he go outside? Did he go to his car to get something? Is there any explanation for why he was one room over and didn't hear it?
I did not leave the home at any time that evening, and I would not have left Christina alone in my apartment for any reason at all at that age. Never did. Didn't do it that night either. Aware of my presence in the living room, I'm sure. The bedroom window intruder would have been especially quiet in order to get away with the deed. Okay. Surely not alone. In my opinion, another set of hands would have made the intrusion not only easier, but a lot quieter, too. I didn't hear anything suspicious. It was warm that evening. There was an oscillating table fan nearby, on high, all evening long. I was listening to music on the stereo next to the computer desk, not blaring, but the music was playing. Whatever, you know, effect that may have tempered my ability to hear strange noises, I was sitting at the computer desk near a wide-open living room windows, and any noises I may have heard might have been coming from outdoors. What few noises were heard were unaware of their origin and were not sounding suspicious. I don't recall having heard anything particularly, you know, suspicious that you wouldn't ordinarily hear in an apartment building, you know, neighboring, you know, tenants, you know, bumps and whatnot. The only unusual noise or sound I heard the entire course of the night was Christina's own voice. So it's not that I didn't hear anything. I didn't hear any, you know, breaking glass or you know, a break-in occurring. But the sound of Christina's voice I did hear, only because I happened to be passing by the bedroom on the way to the bathroom at about 12:30 a.m., during which, when I opened the door, Christina was excited, trying, I believe, to convey to me another person's presence in her bedroom, someone she knew, which at the time was such an unlikely circumstance that I considered flatly impossible, but I was otherwise unable to figure out why Christine was acting strangely. And let me just end this question by saying, if you had a child, Christina's age, and she were awake at 12:30 at night and said, Daddy, my best friend Julie, who lives 15 miles away, is in my closet, would you go look in the closet or just dismiss this as, well, that's not even possible? Unfortunately, that's exactly what I did. And I bear some responsibility for Christina's death, for not having turned on the light and followed her gaze into the darkened corner or looked around to try to discern what she was talking about. But I'm convinced that she was trying to alert me to the presence of somebody else who she named in Christina's bedroom that night at about 12:30. And I'm convinced that, yes, the intruder was already present, either immediately outside the bedroom window or had already entered the bedroom, and that Christina was actually talking to her soon-to-be killer, unaware of the danger that this person posed to Christina's life.
Well, thanks, Bart. That was helpful. Our next question is from Rabia Chowdhury, a world-renowned podcaster and attorney. In fact, she really is the mother of Serial. She was the person who came forward and got Sarah Koenig to do the podcast Serial about her family friend, Anan Saeed. And then she went on to host her own podcast, Undisclosed, which looks at a variety of cases of potential actual innocence all across the United States. And she's also an attorney who specializes in immigration law. So she's a very gifted and talented person, and I was just really happy to have her on our show.
At some point after he put her to bed, he did hear her talking, and he checked in on her, and it seemed like she was talking to herself and smiling, and then he said go back to sleep type of thing and left, and then he didn't check in on her until the next morning. My question would be, like, was that unusual behavior for her? Was that something she did normally, Or was that like an indication that maybe somebody else was in the room with her?
Yes, it was very unusual. Highly, highly unusual. Typically, when I put Christina to bed late at night, when did I put her to bed? Man, it's been so long. I think I put her to bed at about, it was about 10:30 or 11, that's right. And typically, she'll sleep through the entire night. She doesn't wake up in the middle of the night. She doesn't wake up and cry. She doesn't wake up and go to the bathroom, usually. She usually sleeps through the entire night. I knew she was pretty tired when I put her to bed. And she would have been asleep within 5 minutes of me having put her to bed. So, yes, it was very unusual for her to be awakened by whatever it was. I thought that she, and I had told this to the police the next day, not realizing the implications of Christina's awakening in relation to Christina's murder, which I assumed to have occurred much later on that night. And I just thought, well, Christina must have just awakened from this vivid dream or something. And it wasn't just that she was awake, she was talking, seemingly in a conversational manner when I had opened the door, when I had passed by the door, and then she was sitting straight up, she was smiling, and her gaze was sort of transfixed behind me somewhere, it seemed like, and it was very, very unusual, yes. But attributing suspicious character to this, and Christina herself is not the least bit afraid of anything, by whatever it was that had excited her. She was very pleased with herself. And in fact, one of your guests, it was either Charlie or Rabia, said the other day that her own daughter would have played this little game too, to don't tell Daddy, but we're playing this game, just be quiet. That seemed like that's exactly what Christina was doing. She had this little insider joke that was I wasn't quite in on, and she was just smiling from ear to ear about it. Here again, I did not read into this anything like, oh, there's an intruder present about to kill her. So, you know, I'm sorry. I feel terrible that my shortcomings, I wasn't alert enough or suspicious enough to have drawn some nefarious consequence over this event. But and I don't think that anybody else would have. It's just unusual. That's all. Simply unusual, not dangerous or suspicious or anything like that, but definitely unusual.
All right, Bart, thank you very much. And Scott, on to our next question.
Well, Willis, this question comes from Donna. And her question, she has several questions, actually. First one is, did Masuk ever have access to a key to your home?
Yes, she did. And I don't know how she did this. She's an expert on this kind of stuff. I had moved out from the apartment I had shared with her 2 months earlier. And I had been very careful about not letting her have access to this key. I wouldn't even keep it on my key ring. Every time that I visited her or that she had come to my apartment, I always made a special effort to keep this key someplace where she couldn't find it. Where I thought I was careful, I wasn't careful enough because about a week prior to Christina's murder, Masuk showed up in my apartment. Well, maybe it's two or three weeks, a week or two. And I had a female guest. And Masuk would have just gone ape shit. She knew that I had a female guest. So I pretended not to be home. And I locked the door before she had gotten to the door. I had seen her pull up through the windows. And she's banging and banging on the door. As a matter of fact, the neighbors had seen her and reported this to the police a day or two after Christina's murder. The sightings of Masuk pounding on the front door and yelling through the door. Masuk had gone around to the side to the bedroom window, too, and hollered through the bedroom window. Bart, I know you're in there. Let me in, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she comes back to the door, and I'm standing right in front of the door, and I see the door lock, the little latch, turn. And I'm like, oh, my God. She's got a key to my apartment. So before she could push the door open, I went up against the door and held it there with all my weight. She didn't get past the door, but I'm like, how in the hell did she get a copy of the key to my apartment? Yes, she did have a key to my apartment. I don't know how she got it, but it's certainly within her character and means to do this kind of stuff. She's a pro.
Even if she returned it, could she have made a copy?
Didn't even acknowledge that she had it. And in fact, I don't think I ever even confronted her about that, because if I had confronted her about that, she would have known that I was home that day And that would have led to her knowing that they had another female guest at my apartment. So no, I couldn't even reveal to her that I knew that she had another key without sort of exposing myself to further wrath.
Were you ever asleep that evening, or were you awake or on the computer with headphones the whole time?
I was not on the computer with headphones. Music was playing through the stereo. Not particularly loud, but it was playing. No, I was not wearing headphones or earbuds or anything like that. After we returned from McDonald's, I picked up a Happy Meal for her. And while she ate her Happy Meal, I laid down on the couch. This was probably 8:30 or so, and I napped until approximately 10 o'clock while Christina bounded about, were quietly played. And when I woke up, Christina was sitting at the foot of the sofa where I was laying, and she had a couple of her books strewn around the floor and a couple of toys. She had gone into the bedroom and gathered her toys and had gone out and been quietly playing at the foot of my bed. I think I put in a Disney movie, too, before I'm sure I did, The Little Mermaid, right before I'd gone to sleep. So I took about a two-hour nap, I think it was. Woke up approximately 10:30. By this time, Christina was pretty tired, and I dressed her in her pajamas and had her use a toilet, brush her teeth, all that stuff, and tucked her in.
All right, very interesting, Bart. Thank you. And Scott, the next question?
Is from Wesley. In the years since you were convicted, has anyone still been in contact with Masuk?
No, not at all. I've often wondered many times, what is she doing? Is she married now? Does she have any kids? Who else has she gotten away with killing? It sounds like a joke, but it's not. I was certain Christina's murder was not going to be the last that she committed. In fact, I explicitly said so during court hearing. You can read the transcripts yourself, but... And in fact, Masuk did go on to commit at least one other serial killing that we know of, and who knows how many others she got away with just as easily as she got away with Christina's murder. But no, I don't know of anybody that... I think while I was awaiting trial, a girlfriend of mine was a co-worker of Masuk, so I did learn some interesting things during that time while I was awaiting trial. But ever since I arrived in prison, I have had no contact with anybody that knew her, and I had no idea what she had been doing all those years until I received the article of Masuk's arrest for killing her mother-in-law.
What is your relationship with your daughter's mother? Do you continue to have contact with her after you were arrested or convicted?
No, I did not. I attempted to many times. I think the last, even recently, I think the last letter I sent her was probably a year or two years ago when I invited her to attend this DNA hearing in a court hearing a couple of years ago. And this would be like at least probably the 15th or 20th letter that I sent her over the years, beginning with my arrest, and she never responded to any of them. The police and the state attorney's office had managed to put a call block on her phone immediately after my arrest to prevent me from speaking to her. And they went extraordinary means. They were intercepting my mail to Christina's mother to prevent her from hearing anything that I had to say. So this is another just horrible tragedy that she deceived to this extent into believing that the man that she once loved, the father of her child, was responsible for their own child's murder. This is just another tragic, consequence of this. I guess we have to honor, her wishes, because she has suffered no worse than I have over the death of her daughter. There's no question about it. She has been a victim of this every bit as much as myself and even Christina herself.
Seeing as Mimart is one of the most dangerous prisons in the state, have you tried to be transferred to a medium security prison?
No, I have not. Whether you want to move or not, that's not up to you. You have to meet a number of criteria that are pretty strict. They seem to be loosening the criteria now because of overcrowding and other things. But generally speaking, you don't get transferred to a lesser security prison until you've served 20 years. I'm now in my 19th year.
All right, that does it for our episode, Ask Bart, a chance for listeners to actually interact with Barton McNeil from Menard Prison.
What did you think was the most interesting thing he had to say, Willis?
We actually uncovered a bit of contradictory information here because you had said before that you had heard from somewhere that he was wearing headphones during the time that most of this activity was taking place late in the night at his house, but apparently that wasn't the case.
You know, I've been racking my brain as to where that came from. I have to go back to my notes to look. I think I heard that originally from one of the attorneys when I interviewed the attorney that he was on headphones. But maybe it came from Bart's cousin, Chris. I'm not sure. But I'm glad he clarified that. I mean, and I thought it was interesting, too, because, you know, that's something that doesn't necessarily help his case when, I wasn't on headphones. I had the stereo going, but I did not have headphones on. But doesn't that raise some other questions for you, Willis?
Yeah, it does. I mean, conceivably, unless we have to do a double check here and revisit the original trial that occurred, maybe the headphones was not an issue in the trial and it never came up from either prosecution or defense. If it did, then yeah, it's a game changer, I think. If it didn't, then we just have to set the record straight.
Yeah, you know, here's a question for you. Do you reckon that the attorneys on both sides are going to be listening carefully to Bart's answers on this episode?
I would think so. I would think the attorneys would be listening carefully to anything he says because it's not often you get to address a prisoner who's been convicted of a crime much on the record, much less just in a one-to-one setting. So I'm sure that anything he says, which is obviously on the record, he's saying it on a podcast, is going to be something they're going to bookmark in their minds about how it factors into his potential retrial.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, because we don't want people to think we're oriented towards the prosecution or towards the defense. We're going to give the same opportunity to the McLean County State's Attorney, to his office, to answer questions from listeners. We'll let you know if they agree to do such an episode or not in the future, but we're going to reach out to them this week and see if they have some interest in fielding questions from our listeners.
And we thank all of our listeners for writing in and asking questions in the Ask Bart segment, and we also would like to thank those who actually called in and asked their questions to Bart, and of course to our expert panelists that we had on asking questions as well. Next week, Scott, we're going to be considering DNA evidence in this case.
DNA is something that people think can always be definitive. Sometimes it can be kind of ambiguous, and we're going to talk a little bit about that.
All right, that's coming up next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week during Suspect Convictions.